Well, I welcome you tonight. It's a pretty cold, rainy, dreary evening as I was coming in here, and I thought, almost every reading I've ever been to at Michigan State, it seems to be raining or snowing. And every time I walk in the library, I think, this is a dreary place. Why isn't it sunny? Why isn't it nice? But it will when school's over. you know, then it will all pick up. So we're going to begin, and I'd like to just say a few things about this event very briefly. About 4 years ago, I think it was, the Red Cedar Review approached Peter Berg, who is in the back and responsible in large measure to this event, and asked him if he was interested in sponsoring a student reading. The Friday Night Michigan Writer Series had begun, and we thought it might be a good idea to put the spotlight on student writers for at least one of the Friday evenings. And if I recall, you thought that was a good idea. And we started it. And this is our fourth year. Is that correct? I was trying to figure it out. And I think this is our fourth year. And I'm hoping that it will continue and be a tradition for us because it's one of my favorite events. I like very much being a part of, witnessing, launching, hearing students read. And some of the readers tonight, I want to let the audience know, have never read their work in public. This will be their very first time. For some people, they have read a few times, but not much. These are new writers. These are young writers. They are launching themselves. We're here to see this. And I find that very exciting to be a part of that. I perhaps sadistically like to see them be very nervous in advance. Because it allows me to revisit my youth and going through some of those things myself. And there's an adrenaline when you're so new and uninitiated. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. I think it's a great thing to hear students reading their own work for the first time. So thank you.
So I guess I will introduce the second one, who is Christine Junker. By the way, I'm Meg Sparling. I'm the general editor of Red Cedar Review. Although I didn't get a chance to meet Christine until tonight, I have met her George B. Lawson Prize-winning essay, The Heritage of Nymphs. Having grown up in northern Michigan, and just recently, coincidentally, losing my childhood home to the whim of two parents suddenly deciding to relocate to Tennessee, of all places, I was, needless to say, quickly moved by Christine's tale of the presence nature can have on lives in such a place, the way nature results in a deeply felt connection to one's environment, one's place, one's family. Her essay does these feelings a great service, and I read it with a keen nostalgia and understanding. Ladies and gentlemen, Christine Junker.
Hi, the title of my piece is The Heritage of Nymphs, The House. 200 acres, 10 miles north of Everett, Michigan, quaint, antique farmhouse, 4 bedrooms, 2 baths, 10-acre pond. Swimming and fishing in the summer, ice skating in the winter. Cabin on the north side of the pond. Fields ready to be farmed. Maple groves willing to produce scrumptious maple syrup, lilacs. 4 varieties waiting to fill the spring air with heady fragrance. Marsh marigolds, lady slippers, trilliums, spring beauties, and many more, poised to bloom from spring till fall. Morel mushrooms in early May, blackberries for jam and pies in the late summer, and tart, firm apples in the fall. Ivan and Clara Orwig, my great-grandparents, bought a piece of land in northern Michigan, intending to become farmers. They built a barn where they put cows, sheep, and chickens, and plowed fields for hay and clover. But they didn't have the knack of planting and harvesting the hay at just the right time or ensuring that the cows would produce enough milk. and they ended up working in a factory most of their lives. They kept the 200 acres, though, and my great-grandmother consoled herself by turning the front yard into a lavish garden, spending evenings and weekends weeding and watering the delicate blooms with a teacup. In this house, they raised my grandmother, Anda, their only child. She helped weed the flower beds and dragged herself out of bed every morning at 5 a.m. to help with the milking. Every couple of years, she climbed a ladder to help repaint the peaks of the house. When she got married, she became Anda Woods and followed her husband to the small city of Midland where he worked. My great-grandmother eventually decided that she didn't want to maintain the farmhouse that needed frequent coats of paint and constant repairs. Filial piety prompted my grandmother Anda to return to Everett with her family in tow and purchase the house and 40 acres, allowing my great-grandparents to move into a house in town. As it happened, my great-grandparents still spent the majority of their time at the farm, living in a cabin on the lake, a quarter of a mile north of the house. My mother also helped weed the garden, but there were no cows to milk. She spent more time relaxing than either my great-grandmother or my grandmother had, floating in the lake, reading in her favorite tree, walking along deer paths. When she got married, she and my father bought the farmhouse and 40 acres from her parents, and my family settled in. Thus, my sister and I meandered along the same deer paths, floated in the same lake, and were raised on the same land and in the same house that our grandmother and mother had been. It's been pointed out that this farm is an heirloom, passed down not to the men in the family, but to the women. My family is not avowedly matriarchal, however. That's just how it worked out. My great-grandparents had only one child, who happened to be a girl. My grandparents did have a son, but my mother was the oldest and the first to want the house. My parents had only girls. There's not been much opportunity to pass it down to men. It's getting closer to the time when it will be passed again. Great-grandparents. Genius loci. The spirit or guardian deity of a place. The unique quality of a place as felt by an observer, often represented by a serpent. Great-Grandma Orwig's parched hand is clasped in mine as I dip my toes into the bluish-brown water. I gasp as the cold water covers my knees and then engulfs my thighs. When I am standing in water waist high, I glance up to make sure that she's ready. I lean forward until my toes lose their grip on the sand and my body falls into the support of her strong hands, kicking my tiny legs, sending up a spray of droplets. I remember to breathe through my mouth so that my nostrils are not filled with the rich-smelling water of the lake. Slowly, my limbs become more coordinated, I splash less, and the support from her hands lessens and then disappears. Side by side, we doggy paddle, since that's the only stroke we know. I'm showing Great-Grandma Orwig that I can do a backward somersault in the water, when her voice commands me to get out of the lake. Snake, she says, and I scramble towards the shore, the water sucking at my ankles. I see the black head peeking above the rippling surface on the other side of the dock, close to shore. Her hand is around the wiry neck before the snake has a chance to retreat. On shore, she grasps her shovel. I see the glint of metal as it slices down on the slender neck. The narrow rope of a body keeps wiggling, as if dancing to a speedy jazz number, unaware that its head is no longer attached. The leathery palm releases the wooden handle with satisfaction. Grandparents. I walk through the north pines, slightly west of the lake, my hands reaching up to hold those of my grandma and grandpa Woods. We do not walk together in the forest often, but tonight it is warm and fireflies flicker through the air. The ground is covered with red pine needles that have fallen from the trees, making our steps so quiet that it seems like we're floating over the land rather than walking. We build a lean-to by leaning fallen pine boughs against a thick tree trunk, forming a sort of tent. The three of us lie inside, our bodies resting against the fallen needles, pine sap coating our hair, looking through the spaces between the branches into the dark sky. The outside world retreats. The fireflies go dark, the lake dries up, the trees sink into the ground. The world is composed of only the three people sheltered in this lean-to. We stay inside for minutes, hours, days, and then the world slowly grows up around us again. Do you know, after 20 years, that lean-to is still there? Parents. The thermometer registers 14 degrees when the box from Cabela's lands on our front porch. A layer of frost forms over the tape so that when my dad uses his jackknife to cut it open, white flakes fall to the kitchen floor. He pulls out a long sleeping bag that looks more like a mysterious blue water snake than something to sleep in. This is a serious sleeping bag, a North Face designed for winter frosts and storms. The temptation to sleep outside is too great. He and I strap on our cross-country skis and glide into the woods to the oak groves northeast of the lake. Our skis squeak as they break through the snow. When my father sets up the green Kelty tent, I lay sprawled in the snow, fanning out my arms and legs to leave the mark of a snow angel. That night, I crawl into his new winter camping bag, and he into one of his older sleeping bags, one not designed for cold weather. He has to wear all of his clothes to bed. I wear only flannel pajamas with thick socks. My father's red nose is the only thing showing when I wake up in the morning because he has progressively been tightening his mummy bag around him throughout the night. I happily report that his winter camping bag lives up to the promises made in the catalog. The day I graduate from high school is rainy, so the ceremony has to be held in the gym instead of outside. That evening, my mom and I go on a long walk past the lake, through the cedar swamp, and across the fields to the old apple orchard. What matters that day is the red clay clinging to the soles of our shoes, the water squishing between our toes, the gray rain glazing our skin, the smell of worms in the air, the rock beneath my back as I lay down and look up through the gnarled branches of an apple tree too old to give apples. We walk instead of ski through the oak groves in August. My father heads the line. I follow closely and my mother lags behind, trying to coax my sister Michelle into walking a little bit faster. Michelle meanders, taking note in her young mind of the different plants growing on the ground, the indentation of deer hooves marring the path. I am watching her when his hand stops me, and I look down to see a squiggle in the sand, an orange stripe running down its back. We all squat to examine this creature no larger than an earthworm. He puts his hand on the ground, and the swiveling snake crawls in, wiggling in the large palm. We smile, and he releases it again, watching it form perfect letter S's. Sisters, nymphs. Greek and Roman mythology, any of numerous minor deities represented as maidens inhabiting and sometimes personifying features of nature such as trees, water, and mountains, immortal unless they leave their habitat. My sister and I play fancy dresses until our fingers are shriveled and our noses permanently filled with the aroma of the lake. We prance down the dock on our tippy toes, the sun-baked boards burning our feet, swaying our hips and tossing our hair, pretending that we're wearing ball gowns. For the moment, we are girls who wear crimson lipstick and dark eyeliner, who sweep their hair up in elaborate updos and who answer every question with, "I can't do that. I might break a nail." We get fully in character, saying things like, "Oh, don't I look beautiful? This dress cost a fortune, but I'm sure I'll look better than everyone else." Inevitably, one of us accidentally falls off the dock into the water, shrieking and lamenting the ruin of our hair, dress, and makeup, our beauty washed away. Just as inevitably, whichever one of us remains on the dock will get pulled into the water, screeches filling the summer air. Camping in another green tent, a north face this time. Barely enough room for even two people, but it's light and easy to fit into a backpack. Because of the wind, we pitch our tent in the pine forest where we are protected from the gales whipping across the lake. We are silent, and for the first time in weeks, I am able to sleep, cuddled in pine needles and listening to the sound of branches dancing together above my head. Endings. When the main characters of one's life die, is there any replacement, or is there anything but replacement? Mary Oliver, Blue Pastures. Did I forget to tell you that my great-grandma Orwick and I used to see Mickey Mouse playing in the rain, and that I went back to the cabin every day after school throughout my elementary years, and she made me pancakes as big as my plate and let me drink coffee filled with milk and sugar, and that she let me cut her hair even though I was only 6 years old? And that she would let me cook popcorn on the stove without a top so that the popcorn would rocket into the ceilings and come crashing down again onto the floor? Could have I forgotten to tell you these things? Grandma quit seeing Mickey Mouse, though, and the pancake griddle retreated to the back of the cupboard. She had cancer. She ceased then, ceased to be a person, and instead was like the snake grass growing in the fields, brittle green and hollow. She said little more than 20 words after she was diagnosed, even though she still had 2 years of life left. Three of those words were, "I love you," on the night she died. We don't walk together through the oak groves anymore either. My parents' marriage ended when I graduated from high school. My father, foolish man, thought that because after 20 years, this farm was a part of his marrow, that he could stay there, that somehow the land that had been passed through the generations of my mother's family would be given to him. He lives in town now, on 5 acres. He has a backyard, at least. Who's to say what's fair? After the divorce, my mother's not sure she wants to spend the rest of her life living in the farmhouse alone. The house is old, and the repairs that need to be done would empty her bank account and then hurl her into debt. The foundation is sinking, the plumbing rusting, the walls need insulation. My great-grandfather added the bathroom, and unfortunately was no better at carpentry than he was at farming. The walls are crooked, the floor dips, the ceiling is only 6 feet tall. The list of house repairs needed is endless. But my mother's feet have been planted in this red clay for too many years, and she's not sure if she can be safely torn from the land. She worries that she will be like the velvety lilacs in the spring, their splendor withering as soon as they are taken from their home. Heritage. The practicalities of passing the house down and the farm are complicated. The house is in disrepair and fixing it a mammoth undertaking. Job opportunities are sparse, making raising a family there a frightening proposition. It's been assumed that whichever daughter wanted to live there would get the house and the farm. When I contemplate this inheritance, I consider what I would be inheriting. A house that should probably be torn down, a life in a town with dead-end jobs. There's something else, though. 200 acres that is home to blackberries and mushrooms and lilacs and frogs and deer and coyotes and owls and lady slippers and whippoorwills and blue herons and raccoons and dragonflies and earthworms and water snakes and poplars and birches and maples and milkweed. And for a short while, a few humans. It is this something else that I will be inheriting and that will be inheriting me. My sister and I have talked about it, and we have it all planned out. When we get old and our husbands have passed on, we will move into the cabin together. We will walk barefoot through the dew in the morning and swim in the moonlight at night. We will grow a garden and feel the clay squishing between our toes when we pick our food. We will not comb our hair in the morning or shave our legs or apply crimson lipstick to our lips. We will be women of the wild, inheritors of this land and place.
How's it going, everyone? My name's Kyle Figley. I am officially, I think the title is business manager of the Red Cedar Review, which is a real highfalutin way to say that I address envelopes and do math. First off, I'm going to introduce Matt Cavell, who's going to read some poems. I don't know what the titles are or anything, because I didn't check my email. But I do know Matt. Matt and I are in English 443 right now, and Matt's the kind of guy where he doesn't, you know, come into class and shoot his mouth off and to try to make you think his way and, you know, always try to make himself seem right. That's a lot more like me. But Matt sits right next to me, and he's always in there. And I every time I come in, he's reading a book or looking at something or bringing in a DVD to give to someone else or something real interesting. And he's pretty quiet, but whenever he opens his mouth in class, he always seems to say something real profound that makes me feel real stupid, which I think in a lot of ways is what a good poet does. So I don't know. Matt can come up and introduce the rest.
First, I'd like to thank everybody for coming out in such dreary weather. And second, I'm not often afforded the ability to give a mock Oscar acceptance speech of sorts, so I'd just like to thank a few people. Most of all, Katie and my friends that are here now, and Diane McCoskey, I don't know where she's floating around at. There she is, way in the back. And everybody that might be here from my poetry class. In some way, all the poems I write are about you. Whether or not that's good or bad, I'll let you all decide. But each of you have always inspired me, so I'm really honored to be able to share these with everyone here. The first one I'm going to read three poems, of which I submitted each, is Drawer Logic. Laundry day reminds me of my father. Not the act of folding towels or bunching up socks, but the dresser itself. It stands apart, staring at the relationships throughout the room. The bed that drags the wall during the warmest time of night when rhythms become one long moan. And how the books, closed and expectant, sit like eager summoners casting subtle spells and singing lustful lies. And how the shelf holds them close, like a deaf man drinking in vibrations from a parade. My father rests there, remembered in the drawers of himself. That stocky, milky crimson bulk with antique eyes of dull silver seems like a tempered photograph or like a finished portrait by a nouveau artist. The knobs blinking in poor light as aging eyes which rise above a stern drawer bottom, a wooden jaw. But those drawers themselves, more than internal organs, they are the keepers of his soul. But on laundry day, when my mind wanders, the drawer logic is obvious. Stoically, my father camouflages the dirty underwear with new packaged pairs, the blood that hydrogen peroxide can't dissolve, and the shit that can't be bleached. These were his daily concerns. And in the corner, watches me, folding his laundry, my laundry, folding until my own drawers seep cotton. The second poem I'm going to read is Map of Explanation. It's the newest poem that I've written that was submitted. I have soaked our globe in the bathtub with oil beads, dragged a loofah across the poles. For 2 hours, the globe floats, and I roll it over. The center is air. The paper lies bloated, hanging with sinews of glue. The globe is jetsam that smells like apple oil beads. This oily textured skin is what I want, to cut at the meridian and lay it splayed on the tile floor. Make a Mercator projection. Carve away Texas with a shaving razor. Pestle a bottle of ibuprofen to color Michigan larger. With tweezers, coax a few hundred miles out of South America. Shrink the U.S. with a hand towel and blow dryer. I would call to you over the sound of running water, but you would be asleep on the sofa. What does it matter? I'm asleep in the bathtub, my mountain wrinkled skin in the cold ocean of bathwater. I don't know why I need a map, but I know why I don't want a globe. A globe has infinite antipodes. As the sun sees, there is always a dark face on the opposite side. To the cartographer, a map has no antipode, and by design, the other side is blank. And then the one that I won the prize for and have been afforded the absolute privilege of reading to you this evening is America Discovering Columbus, Lover to the One Who Had Loved. We are discovering each other the way America uncovered itself for Columbus. He was, and you are, not the first. He wasn't, and I will not be the last. My hair is the flint vein of arrowheads. My teeth are oyster shells shaved to keenness. My sex is the Arawak tribe, giving in to a fault. Of a three-ship dowry you brought, I have crushed one on the rocks. Do you have enough space in that two-chamber cargo hold beating the slave bodies against the concave wood? Can you make the vessel lighter than water, float home, even when filled with flint, oyster shells, and my tribe? From silt-rich rivers you want gold. From the children born of my tribe you want sex. You come to me on your repeat sojourns, whispering just a little less than everything, stringing my brass neck in copper coins. From me you want a cartography I can't give. You want me to shorten the world. You want me to be Asia. Thank you.
All right, next up is Jesse Phillips, who was a winner for fiction this year. And I've known Jesse actually quite a long time. She's probably about the first person I think I met on campus. My freshman year, I had class with Jesse 8 a.m. on Mondays. It was an acting 101 class, and it was a pain to go to, and some days it was a pain to sit through. But she always made it fun, and we always had a lot of fun in it. And I remember one thing about the class that always stuck out to me is that we had to do these journals. It was like a theater department thing that when you're in the acting class, you have to write a journal about what you're learning and what you're doing and how the acting is affecting you. And nobody ever takes it seriously or knows exactly what to put in it. And we'd sit in class, and Jesse would say something like, well, what am I going to write in this? And I said, I don't know, make something up. And it turns out she's real good at that. Because she won last year as well, and this year not only did she win for fiction, but she's also runner-up for nonfiction. Tonight she's going to be reading a portion of Half Awake, which is a story she won for, and a short called Cowboy Boots.
Thanks, Kyle. That was beautiful. I'm reading a very short portion of a very long story. I just like to say that it's long, because I'm really proud that it's long, because I used to write really, really short things, so it's kind of a breakthrough. But, okay, I think I'll start. Renee sits in a chair in her apartment, next to a table of food. She has already eaten 3 plates and is now on her fourth. Pregnancy has made her ravenous. She decided to give up vegetarianism for a while, and found a deeply buried appetite for barbecued chicken wings, meatballs out of crock pots, beans with slabs of bacon, and chunks of lunch meat eaten sans sandwich. She is stuffing them all into her mouth, and the energy of eating, along with the lack of air conditioning, has caused beads of sweat to break out in her nose, forehead, and on the back of her neck. Her long black hair is on top of her head in a messy pile, and she is wearing lipstick, which she almost never does, that is smudged and goopy from the heat and the food. It is important for her to look attractive today, so she spent extra time getting ready this morning. She knew everyone was going to be looking at her, judging her, and she wanted to surpass their expectations. Lansing has been encapsulated in a bubble of urban heat. There's nothing to enjoy about the heat here, There are no beaches and few swimming pools. She's not seen the Great Lakes since she was a child on a field trip. She's wearing a long-sleeved black shirt and long skirt. Her only black clothes, appropriate for a funeral, are inappropriate for the unusually hot weather. She sets her empty plate on the floor of her house to pick up later, but Jacob's mother bends down and picks it up as she walks by. "Thanks," Renee tells her. "I was going to..." "No, I've got it," she says, smiling. It must come automatically for her, picking up after everyone, Renee thinks. How pathetic. 9 members of Jacob's family followed her here after his funeral. His 2 parents, his older brother, an aunt and uncle, and a few cousins. The funeral had been family only, at the request of Jacob's parents, and Renee had been glad. She knows she won't be hearing from any of her and Jacob's friends and now anyway. Jacob's family is now milling around her house, looking at pictures, walking about in the yard, inspecting. They brought all the food from the reception back to her house, an act of charity that would have annoyed her if she wasn't so damn starving all the time. They're discussing things under their breath. She hears Jacob's mother crying upstairs. She assumes she's looking at Jacob's things. Renee hopes to God she hasn't seen the sack of weed in the top shelf of her closet that she forgot to hide. Oh, who cares, she then thinks. Maybe that's why she's crying. Jacob didn't talk about his family much, even though Renee liked hearing about them and asked about them often. They were the sort of family that posed for pictures twice a year, wanting to document every hairstyle that might have changed or tooth that might have fallen out in the 6 months since the last portrait. Renee has no parents. Her mother died of cancer when she was a toddler. She had been raised by her grandmother, who was old-fashioned and distant most of the time, but who provided her with the basic necessities. Men had never been in her life growing up. She had no grandfather or father. But as a child, it seemed to her that not having these things was no different from her friends who didn't have cats or goldfish. She had a cat. She just didn't happen to have a father, a grandfather, or a mother. Three years ago, her grandmother had died as well, as if she had been waiting to make sure Renee turned out halfway decent before joining the other third of their small family. I should probably mingle more, Renee thinks, as she looks around her house at everyone, but she doesn't move. Renee cried little at the funeral. She figures she has cried enough the past few days to make up for it, and she didn't feel like crying in front of people she doesn't know. Jacob's mother sits down in the chair next to Renee's. Her wrinkled face is mascara-stained, but not a hair is out of place in her short bob. "We've been talking about what you're planning to do now, Renee, with the house." "What do you mean?" Renee says. "We don't own this house, we just rent it." Renee notices she is still using the plural we. She silently commits to not doing that anymore. "Well, are you going to stay here?" "Yes, of course." His mother sighs. Renee is glad she looks fat in the black short suit she is wearing. Her black nylons do nothing to conceal the map of varicose veins on her chunky white calves. Renee thinks that if Jacob's mother was beautiful, she would be completely impossible to tolerate. As is, Renee is struggling. "It's not in a very good part of town, Renee." Renee smiles and nods. "It's in a normal part of town. Normal people live here. It's not the suburbs. It's not a subdivision. It's safe here. There's nowhere else I'd really want to live." "What about one of the nicer little towns on the outskirts of Lansing?" "I don't have a car. I have to go to work. I have to be where I can walk." "And you feel safe here all alone?" Renee doesn't really feel that safe, especially now that it is summer and the windows are open. She knows it would be so easy for someone to come in the house, but she nods her head yes. "How long do you have a lease on this house?" "Till January, I think." "You know you're getting money," his mother whispers suddenly, as if she is telling her a huge secret, a secret that will sway the argument permanently in her favor. Renee takes a long time to answer. "Yes, I was told that yesterday by your husband. We just want you to use it wisely. We are here to help guide you with anything you need, anything at all." Renee pulls a fake smile from deep within. "Thanks," she says. "I'll keep that in mind." The second piece I'm reading is called Cowboy Boots. And since my mom was kind enough to drive all the way up here to see me, I feel that I should explain that this is entirely fictional so that she doesn't feel weird, because that'd be bad. Okay. I was 7 when my family thought I was kidnapped. There was a party going on at my house, more like a daytime gathering of sorts, and no one was really paying attention to me. There were always a lot of people over at our farm, cousins, neighbors, friends. They were all sitting around in our kitchen, back when I had lime green linoleum and an orange spotted mushroom decals on the cupboards. When we were kids, it was a little more acceptable to sit around smoking pot in front of your children, don't you think? You can't very well do that today without having Child Protective Services at your door. Everyone would sit me on their knee while they passed it around, never blowing it in my face or anything like that. Everyone was really nice to me. I asked my grandma if I could take a walk, and my grandma said, "Yes, of course, honey. I don't think she even heard what I said. Just said yes to get me to leave her alone so she could laugh and party with the others. It was sunny and warm that day for only being March. I was wearing my cowboy boots. I had these turquoise cowboy boots with tiny plastic rhinestones that I never took off for about 1 year, even when I slept. And of course, my parents were into that free will thing, so they didn't mind. The farm was still brown from winter, but the bright sun was making all the dead weeds and bare tree branches shine and seem alive. I would stop every few feet or so to wipe the mud off my boots or the back of my shirt sleeve. I was really protective of those boots. I remember wondering if it was okay for me to be walking alone in the woods. Since my grandmother had said yes, I figured it was. I felt safe there. I was never scared of much when I was a child. I'd been on walks before in our woods, so I knew where I was going. I remember singing as I walked along, since I was still at the age and I thought, if I sang pretty enough, birds and squirrels would come join me like in the movies. After an hour or so of walking, I turned around and headed home. I got back as the pink, fuzzy light of dusk was beginning to fall on the farm. I saw three police cars parked in the driveway. You know how small towns are, everyone comes together over the littlest things, and the cops are secretly happy to have something to do. Everyone at the party was out in the fields looking for me, calling my name. My mom was out galloping her horse around the woods, looking for me, crying all stoned and shit. I learned when I was older there had been this big fight about whether to call the cops, what with everyone stoned and drinking, and pot growing behind the barn. My grandma was crying and holding me by the shoulder, shaking me, and then I started crying and saying, "You told me I could, you told me I could." She started saying, "Shut up, I did not, I would never tell you you could." I don't know why she did that. I don't know if she just didn't remember telling me or if she was trying not to look bad. I know she told me I could take a walk, though. I'm absolutely sure of it.
Okay. I'm Dan Rosine. I'm the fiction editor for Red Cedar Review. Our next reader, I hadn't ran into him for a couple years now, but me and him go way back. We used to run up against each other in debate rounds in high school a lot. And before the reading, we were reminiscing about one particular instance where Les and his debate partner had just gotten finished destroying us in this round. And my partner and I made off with the only copy they had of their debate case with the intent of researching it later and being able to destroy them the next time we ran up against them. However, we didn't know that was the only copy of their case. So the next round, they came in barging in the middle of our round, or Les did, while his partner was cussing about me to an ex-graduate from my high school who happened to be their judge for the next round. But despite that, they managed to win that round as well. Despite being an excellent debater, our next reader is a man of many talents otherwise, including writing essays. Let's give it up for Les Lim.
Thanks, Dad. Now I sound like an asshole. But that's always good to go to a crowd with. All right. My essay is called Prelude and Fugue in Minors. Prelude. The first thing you notice about the Shriners Hospital for Children is the vast expanse of handicapped spaces in the parking area. It immediately imparts a sense of grim pragmatism to an edifice built upon the most optimistic of ideas that children who need special medical attention should be able to get it for free. The handicap signs form a single column stretching into the distance, a long chain of stern metal posts, a sturdy phalanx set to defend the choicest spots from the lucky ones who still enjoy a full range of motion. We park in the back of the lot. I was 10 years old the first time I came to the hospital. Chicago was a wonderful oddity to me then, a schizophrenic metropolis. Chicago was the Latino quarter where wholesalers gave us coffee and bagels, and my dad bought exotic goods for our family grocery store. Or it was the alien mystique of Chinatown, with its beautifully strange architecture and herbal boutiques and pigs and ducks hanging in butchers' windows. Other times it was Michigan Avenue, bustling with fashion and movement, buildings taller than God. It seemed as if the city was constantly disappearing and reappearing, a series of urban brigadoons, each unaware of the existence of other Chicagos. It was any other city as it would look shown through a prism, each component expanded and more than the sum of its parts, every hue distinct and luminous. The Shriners Hospital was not a color I had seen before. I was accustomed to the conventional strangenesses of Chinatown or the wholesale district, but here was a thoroughly unimportant-looking building crawling with old men in peculiar hats. The red fez is a great symbol of the ancient Arabic order of the nobles of the mystic shrine, distinguishing it from the other Masonic orders. It's considered a sign of nobility and philanthropy, and it's been proudly worn by members for over 100 years. The Shriners take their fez seriously. I, however, could not. Nothing in the entire history of secret playground clubs and special handshakes could rival the absurdity of these men wearing those hats, which looked not unlike an overturned KFC bucket lovingly perched on your grandfather's head. This wasn't Michigan Avenue. I couldn't decide what part of Chicago I had gotten into. The confusion only deepened when I saw the hospital commons. It was a spacious, well-decorated area designed to take full advantage of natural light. A generous number of trees and plants brightened the atmosphere, along with a few well-kept potted flowers. There was a black baby grand piano with a bright tone in one corner, and two colorful play areas for smaller children in others. And everywhere were wheelchairs, prosthetics, splints, and braces connected to children of all sorts. It was like stumbling into some postmodern version of Leonardo's workshop, or John Cage composing the human form, an etude of irregular symmetries and mechanical aids. I didn't know what to think about it, this menagerie of toddlers, but it scared me in ways that left me ashamed. The whole enterprise carried such an air of dashed expectations, of failure. I sat on a bench, pulled out my Walkman, and turned up Gershwin as loud as it could go. When it came time for my appointment, a thin young man brought me to a small lab where they recorded my height and weight, snapped some Polaroids, and took a series of X-rays. Afterwards, he led me to a clean white office where a doctor was waiting. She had a kind face, and we small-talked for a bit. And she asked me, "Do you know why you're visiting us today?" I said no, that my mother had only told me that I would be going to Chicago and that we were going to see a doctor. I'd had shots before and gotten my blood taken once or twice, and it hadn't been all that bad. "Okay," she said. "Let me just tell you that there's nothing wrong with you and that you're a perfectly healthy boy. You've taken good care of yourself, but there's something very special you need to know about your neck." She paused to rummage through a folder and pulled out one of my X-rays. "Two of the bones in your neck, your vertebrae, are fused together and have been that way since you were born. We don't know how it got that way, and we can't even tell you what it's called because it's so rare that it doesn't have an official name. It's fine now. It shouldn't give you any pain or stop you from having a perfectly normal life." She put the X-ray back in the folder and pushed it aside. "But soon your body is going to start growing and changing size and shape, and we want to make sure that your bone doesn't cause you any trouble while that happens." I knew about the spinal cord and how the vertebrae protected it from harm because it was how your brain controlled the rest of your body. She didn't need to explain to me how fragile it is, and I didn't ask. She continued. "We'd like you to visit us once every year for a while so that we can take new pictures and X-rays and keep you shipshape. Would that be all right?" I nodded. "Great. By the time you're 16 or 17, you'll probably be all done with us, and you'll be able to get on with being an adult." She chuckled. "Do you know what you want to be when you grow up?" What I'd wanted to be was the first Asian basketball star to play in the NBA. But all of a sudden, I was afraid of growing taller. I mustered up all of my courage and said, "I don't know." She laughed again. "Probably better that way. Why limit yourself?" she said. "So long as there's hope, you can do anything and everything." Later, I watched cars pull out of handicapped parking, their spots immediately replaced by other vehicles bringing more patients, the process constant and repeating without end. Fugue. When I visited the next year, the first thing I noticed about the hospital was the vast expanse of handicapped spaces. The second thing I noticed was the unmistakable sound of Bach emanating from the commons. The precision of Bach and the brightness of the piano drew me in, and walking over, I saw that a girl of about 16 was hunched over the keys, immersed in Baroque. It was later in the evening, and there weren't many people nearby. I pulled up a chair next to her and sat down, but she didn't even seem to see me. Listening closer, I could hear her humming along with Bach, loudly, as if she couldn't control it, like the spirit of Glenn Gould had taken up residence in her vocal cords. She finished with a flourish. Most of the people in the room clapped enthusiastically, and I joined in. She flushed and said, "Thank you." I told her that I could play a little Bach, but only some of the simpler 2- and 3-part inventions. Really, play something for me, she said. I eagerly took the challenge and stumbled into the invention in C major, a staple of any aspiring pianist. I hit a few bad keys before I was done and smiled sheepishly back at her. I'm not very good, I said. Nonsense, she replied. I can tell you're going to be a great Bach player someday. You just need to have more fun with the themes. I answered with a look of confusion. She explained, everyone thinks Bach is just like math, so that it should come out the same every time. Bach is so much more than that. You can hear it in the musical theme in every one of his pieces. It's the first thing you hear in every invention, every sinfonia, every fugue, and then it disappears. She tapped out the theme of the invention in C major, the first 2 measures. It's not gone, though, because it keeps coming back, again and again, a little bit different, maybe, but definitely there, in the right hand, in the left hand, in both hands, in the melody and in the harmony. It's like Bach took a musical moment in time and stretched it out, kept it going so that it was like it never had to stop. I love it. I want to play Bach in Carnegie Hall someday. There was a pause as I tried to take it all in. I didn't think I understood much of what she said, but it was wonderful nonetheless. I asked her what she was at the Shriners Hospital for. She pointed to her feet, and it was for the first time that she had braces on her legs and ankles. She said that she had something called Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease, and that because of it, her feet and legs often became weak and numb. Soon she would need to use a wheelchair for part of the day. Worse yet, she explained, she would start to feel it creeping into her forearms and hands. She thought that playing piano would keep her fingers strong enough to function, and that maybe the exercise would help her hold back the disease, but there is no cure. Before long, it was time for my appointment. I thanked her for talking with me, and she smiled. She started playing again as I was led away, captivated by the movements of sonatas, oblivious to the motion of time. When I came back to the hospital at age 12, I saw her there again, sniffing at the flowers. Now, though, she was an 8-year-old girl in a tight back brace, suffering from severe scoliosis. Though the brace hindered her movement, she carried herself with the grace and bearing of a ballerina. Visions of leaps and pirouettes danced through her mind, and she dreamed of an open stage. At 13, I caught a glimpse of her as a 15-year-old in the hospital cafeteria, writing long stories in a spiral notebook. Though osteogenesis imperfecta kept her and her brittle bones in a wheelchair, the paragraphs in her notebook spoke of a strengthened structure far beyond her years. Without any other escape from the present, she wrote her future. I noticed her again year after year, always in slightly different form. Once as a 12-year-old future screenwriter with cerebral palsy, again as a 16-year-old aspiring chef with a prosthetic leg, then a 10-year-old painter with spina bifida. She showed me more and more each time that the hospital wasn't a shrine to the disappointment of human potential, but to the celebration of it. Sometimes now I think of her, the original theme, and I wonder if she's still able to play. I play Bach at 21 almost as well as she did at 16. I understand more now how you can play Bach and seem to stretch time forever. When I play the piece that I heard from her 10 years ago, Fugue number 16 in G minor, I can see her again, suspended in that almost infinite musical moment. And I notice myself beginning to hum along.
Our next reader, I haven't known quite as long as Les, but I have gotten to know him over the last year as he's been a reader for the Red Cedar Review. In the last year, he's also been working closely with Marcia Aldrich, writing fiction, and he's a senior in English, and please give it up for Scott Larner.
I didn't give Dan much to work with there. I think I'm the specific person that Professor Aldrich was talking about, the watching sadistically as my nerves deteriorated over the week. And at the beginning of the week, she told me, you know, you can't read the story you won for because it's 15 pages long, single spaced, and it'd take you an hour to read, and the people don't want to listen to you for that long, Scott. And so she said, well, you have the shorter piece that we can make better. So I gave it to her on Wednesday, and I went in on Thursday to talk to her, and she looked at me, and she was like, you're going to have to read your longer piece tomorrow, Scott. So I'm going to read a selection from the beginning of The Coveting, which is the story that I won the Jim Cash Award for. And like Jesse, I also have to make a disclaimer, since my parents are here. Although this is from the first-person perspective from a young woman, I am not, in fact, a woman, so. Okay. The winter dusk was fading, and I could see snow falling in the halos of the courtyard lamps through the sliding glass door as I walked into the apartment. I set my suitcase down and sat on the couch in the dark, looking at the outlines of posters on the opposite wall. I was tired. It was the Friday before classes started again, and I had just gotten back from a 2-day trip with my mother to Evanston to see her sister. It had been a 5-hour drive home. The light on the answering machine was blinking. Brian had left the message. Alexis, this is Brian. Sorry I didn't call sooner. Your dad said you were out of town till today. I'll try and call later. Brian was a friend of mine from high school. He was tall, with a soft, warm handshake and liquid movements that washed over his body, eroding the sharpness of his masculinity. He had shy hands, hands practiced in prayer, never reaching out to make casual contact with the skin on my arms or touch my back or grab my shoulders to give aggressive, awkward massages, though sometimes in the past I wish they would have. He went to Pinedale Bible College in Indiana, and he usually called to ask me to breakfast when he came home. It was a tradition we had started our senior year in high school when he was president and I was the vice president of the Honor Society. We met for breakfast every Saturday then. A member of Brian's church owned the restaurant we went to, and most of the patrons were elderly couples. He always knew their names and would ask them about their weeks. I would stand next to him smiling. When we went to our table, Brian would always help me take my coat off and pull out the chair, and I felt like we were one of those old couples in the restaurant. It felt nice. Normally on Christmas, he called in between Christmas Day and New Year's Day. I felt slightly disappointed when I left with my mom on the 2nd for Evanston, but there was the message on the machine now. It surprised me how good I felt when I heard his voice. I pushed the button again. Alexis, this is Brian. Sorry I didn't call sooner. Your dad said you're out of town today. I'll try and call later. I lay down on the couch and fell asleep with my coat on. The phone woke me up. It was Brian. His voice was nervous, breathy. He said hello, paused, and then questioningly added my name. Alexis? Alexis, he always said. Never Alex. Why don't you call me Alex, I asked. I thought I could hear him smile on the other end of the line. I like Alexis. It's pretty, I guess. Alexis, he said again, letting the X and the S roll. Who wouldn't want to say Alexis? Everyone calls me Alex. Brian laughed and changed the subject, asking general questions about my life. The nervousness was absent from his voice. He talked with music in his words like an actor or a preacher. What I was wondering, Brian said, clearing his throat, what I was actually calling for, one of my friends is having a post-Christmas, post-New Year, pre-back-to-school kind of get-together for some of his friends, and it's tomorrow, so I was wondering, would you like to accompany me? I told him I would. I told him I would without even thinking. The phone was hung up before I thought about it at all. Why had Brian asked me to a party? We could have just gone to breakfast tomorrow morning. We always just went to breakfast. Maybe I would rather just go to breakfast. When we went to breakfast in high school, we would talk like we were close, tell each other what we were thinking about, what we planned on doing, but we never did anything else. He had asked once if I wanted to go to church with him, but I told him I didn't do that kind of thing. I remember the first time I really noticed Brian. He was leading a circle of kids in a prayer outside the school by the flagpole. They were holding hands, and in the cold I could see little puffs of condensing breath escaping from their synchronized lips. I couldn't hear their words, just the rhythm of the prayer growing and fading like the hum from an old fluorescent light. The faces in the prayer circle looked like the faces of the other kids standing outside the school in the cold. There was nothing unusual. There was no gold tint in the little puffs of prayer breath. Brian, though, looked different. He looked pious, sincere, his eyes closed, his body rigid and firm, enforced with determined faith. I remembered that moment when he asked me to go to church, every moment when I thought that I would be brave and ask him to go somewhere with me, to take me someplace other than breakfast. I was terrified by the seriousness in that face. I wondered if he had decided to call me this vacation, but felt guilty at the last moment. He was so nice to people that sometimes it felt cold. Being with Brian was like being in a lake at night in the summer, when the air was colder than the water, and you knew the only way to stay warm was to stay submerged. Was I making up the cold I felt in his invitation now? Maybe I would call him back and ask why he decided to take me to this party instead of to breakfast like normal. Why he had waited so long to call, but I didn't. Instead, I turned on the kitchen light and started to make dinner. When Brian knocked on my apartment door the next day, I was putting on lipstick. It wasn't my custom to wear lipstick or the tight jeans and shirt I borrowed from my roommate's drawer. I thought that I would change my custom this one time, like Brian had changed his custom, make him wonder about what I was doing the way I wondered about what he was doing. When I opened the door, he gave no indication that he even noticed. Just a polite, "How are you?" and a smile, no contact, no hug. Brian's hand did seem colder than usual. He was nervous, or maybe it was just cold outside. I grabbed my coat and walked by his side down the stairs to his old white car, feeling awkward in the stupid clothes, wishing I could be back in my room. I picked up a map off the passenger seat and sat down in the car. There was a pile of books and papers separating me from Brian. At first, I thought they were books from his last semester, but they were Bible school manuals. "I'm teaching fourth graders at the church," he said. "That's nice." I straightened my coat. "I've been doing it down in Indiana, too." The radio was playing music that sounded like standard radio pop, guitars, drums, and overdone vocals, but I didn't recognize the song. It must have been a religious station. 101 The Power, 93.7 The Light. I had seen the bumper stickers. Brian turned it down so that we could hear each other. "How have your classes been going?" Brian asked, and we talked about school and classes around pauses in the conversation. The heater was blowing directly at me, and I turned the vent away. Brian told me that he had to take 3 more engineering classes so he could graduate in May. "I don't know about it, though, Alexis. Engineering, I mean. I spent 2 weeks this past summer in Boston, witnessing on the street, you know, telling people about the Word of God. It was amazing, the people that you meet and the stories that they tell you about the way God works in their lives. It was incredible. I think I might want to do something like that, all the time, for a living." I didn't answer him. I thought about him standing on a street in a big city, randomly talking to people who passed by. I couldn't imagine what Boston looked like, but I imagined it as cold. In the picture, Brian looked like he did when I saw him by the flagpole. I still couldn't hear what he was saying. "So," he said, breaking the silence, but his sentence died as he read the green highway sign telling us we were 5 miles from our exit. I picked the map back up, and it felt like late October leaves against... I picked up the map, and my hands felt like late October leaves against the paper. The map was just a clutter of crossing lines, with the Millers scribbled in pen across the top of the page. The fan from the heater made the only noise inside the car. I looked at Brian, studying the lines of his face. His eyes wavered, but stayed straight ahead, like he was deliberately trying not to look at me. "This is going to be great," he said. We got off the highway, and Brian drove down a country road that traced forgotten property boundaries through a mismatched collection of cornfields and ranch houses. I set down the map and looked out the windows at the houses with aluminum siding and aluminum swing sets. The seats from the swing sets were buried, and the rusted chains hung limp, dying into the stale piles of deep snow. They looked like normal subdivision houses, but instead of being patterned and crammed together like tulips in an old lady's garden, they were scattered randomly like windblown weeds. "What's the map say, Brian?" Or, "What's the map say?" Brian turned to look down without taking his eyes off the road. I picked up the map again. "It's after the next bend, on the left. You've never been here?" "Just once. I know these people from church." "Oh, I never considered that these people would be from church." I was nervous now that maybe this was more a trap than a party. Was I like one of those people in Boston, brought to the middle of nowhere to hear the pitch? A girl to be passed around from smiling face to smiling face, sucked into the warmth of family and Christian values like a fly into tree sap?
Would there be Bibles scattered around? Maybe the little ones, like the old men with double-breasted suits and bald heads passed out on the corners of the streets at school every fall and spring? Would there be group prayers with phrases like, "We thank you for the guest you've brought here to us today, O Lord. And help us in our quest to spread your word, O Lord. And yours is the true way, O Lord. May it come to be to all your children under the sun. Blessed art thou, O Lord. Amen." The car pulled into a long, unpaved driveway. Amen, I thought.
Is Angela here? Great. Okay. I know what to do now. I include Angela Vasquez Giroux in a group of 5 to 10 very promising young poets I have come into contact with in the past 4 years. But I decided last year at a student writer's night reading that her poetry takes on a whole new magic when she reads it out loud. Angela's poetry has tones of vitality, earthiness, sorrow, and obsession. Angela's voice, as would only be proper, shares these characteristics. Having come into contact with her poems repeatedly in the past 4 years of my life at MSU, at readings and published in RCR issues, I always feel altered somehow, emerging from them. Her poetry never ceases to be moving, thoughtful, and elegant. Her first place Jim Cash Prize-winning poems this year are entitled Bronze Star, White Flag, and Why You Should Never Have Asked Me to Quit Smoking. Ladies and gentlemen, Angela Vasquez Giroux.
I am lucky enough to make this the third April in a row I think I've gotten to read. And I think as I'm getting older, and by older I mean 23, I have seen my work change, but also the work of everyone who's helped me change. And I really would be at fault if I did not recognize Ann McCoskey for being patient with me and not yelling at me when I bring her things that aren't very good. That said, I'm going to read 3 poems tonight, the 3 that won the Jim Cash. The first is entitled Bronze Star, and it is a poem for my sister and mostly about my sister. The background info on it is that my sister, who is currently a sergeant in the military serving in Kuwait, she came home from boot camp 1 year, well, the first year she was in, and she told us all that she was going to be living in South Korea for a year. And my mother's father, my abuelito, had been in the Korean War, but had never talked about it. And he just piped up and said, "You know, mija, I was in Korea once with the army during the war. They gave me a bronze star." And this is the poem. 1. The first picture of my sister in the army fixes the way she looked before I lost her to the military, before she lost her language to acronyms like PLDC and AIT. In the picture, she is smiling, the brown clay of her face still soft, glazed with the light of the flashbulb. The flag drapes triangularly behind her. The constellations of the blue field are her crown. She is the most patriotic I have ever seen her. She is wearing a set of fatigues, a camouflage pattern that makes her disappear into the earth, into the mottled greens, browns, blacks. Even the colors of her clothing have emotion all their own. They cannot stop moving, not even in the stasis of the frame. They run past its edges. They make her less solid. 2. My sister finds a bronze monument sculpted for the soldiers of the Korean War, finds our abuelito's name inscribed somewhere at its base, writes our mother a letter. Our mother tries for a long time to find out how he got the Bronze Star, tries to track down the paper of the citation with long papers of her own, letters to the government, letters to Korea, letters my sister writes in Korea to her commanding officers. The building where the papers were kept burns down in the northern part of the base, the papers thinning to ash, to dust. 3. When Walito dies, my sister is still in Korea. She takes an old Korean air jet home to the States. It is the first time I have seen her in months when she walks into the funeral home, saying she is stiff, her limbs hardened from the 16-hour flight. We pin the bronze star to the breast of his suit, just beneath the silken gold of the kerchief in his pocket. Our mother does not cry until we are burying him 2 days later, until he and the star are going into the frozen ground, until a group of veterans come near the dirt and play taps. They fire 3 shots, the shells of the rifle rounds resting just above the soil. My sister bends and grasps one with her fingers. It is a dirty gold. It is still warm. It is all she has of Walito to carry back to Korea with her. She holds it tight until it makes a small star in her palm. When she stands again and touches my hand, she is all bronze to me, shining against the black of her funeral suit. The second poem I'm going to read is White Flag, and it's a response to seeing an image of the somewhat famous Jasper Johns painting entitled White Flag on September 12th of 2001 in a class. And it also invokes and makes use of my obsession with Mark Rothko, a famous painter, or my famous painter, I guess. And again, sort of concerned with the military. White Flag. In HA 452 Contemporary Art, the professor shows a slide, Jasper John's White Flag. We talk about the artist as a bridge between abstract expressionism and minimalism, as a man who, like me, wanted so badly to be able to stop loving Mark Rothko, but could not. How even in the precise lines of the flag, faded and nearly blank against the canvas, you can see the strokings of his brush. How the flag nearly isn't there without Mark Rothko. The professor begins to talk about the avant-garde, about the origin of the word. It comes, she says, from the military term vanguard, meaning to go ahead of the troops and draw fire. It is a heroic thing. It is self-sacrifice. Then what of your flag, Jasper Johns? When my professor calls you avant-garde and shows your white, dematerializing flag, what does that mean? In a month, my sister will tell me that she has stopped loving her husband, my best friend. I will cry on the phone to her, and she will say, "Females are so weak. That is what I learned in the military." 3 weeks later, my dog will have died in her sleep, and the man I thought I could love will be angry with me for not calling him back early enough. The headaches will be back. I will be smoking again, and I will even begin to wonder why I love Mark Rothko at all. It will be pathetic, really. It will be a bad country song. Mark Rothko will write a letter and tell me I only hurt because I love, that the world isn't all white and gesture, that I have to learn to love the red things again. But when I am finished reading, and Mark Rothko has forgotten me all over again, I will see only your flag, Jasper Johns, a white flag that would never have existed without Mark Rothko. What does it mean to surrender, Jasper Johns? And the last poem I will read is entitled, Why You Should Never Have Asked Me to Quit Smoking. And it is based in somewhat truth. And it's sort of, I really bogarted the title from another poet in our circle, Sarah Sword, who was usually at these nights, who wrote a great poem called Why I Would Never Ask You to Quit Smoking. So this is sort of my take and my response. Part 1. Because in every picture of Mark Rothko, he is smoking. He is smoking with a daughter on his knee. He is smoking looking 9 feet high at a mural panel. He is smoking over the studio sink in the moments before he dies. You know of him only what you have seen in my home. The stack of books which reaches my knees in the corner near the bed. My knee where for the last 6 weeks, blood has been settling into a bruise. I tell you, I know he painted something its color once. I even show you, untitled, 1960. Part 2. Because when I was a child, spiraling around the backyard, singing that song of the Red Death my father taught me, ashes, ashes, we all fall down. He smoked on the back porch steps, waving his fingers through the curls of basic ultralight smoke, scolding me to keep my hands out of the flat amber ashtray. And even now, I can't help but dip my fingers into it, tracing small rectangles on the insides of my wrists, forearms, thinking of the last series of Rothko's, the dark mouth exhaling into a breath of gray. Part 3. Because it was my perfect New York moment, standing outside of the old studio at 222 Bowery Street, smoking a scarlet papered cigarette from the golden box of Fantasia Naturals, wrists and fingers curling around the iron gates at the entrance. I want to call you and tell you that the gates must be ancient, but have never rusted. They've ashed. Part 4. Because I didn't remember Walito smoking Camel filters until my father showed me the picture. In it, I am a child. I am so small that I am a stub of a child looking up at him, his elbow resting on the kitchen sink, wrist bent above the ashtray. I must have loved the red of its burn. And even now I look up, the picture hanging at the ceiling, my father saying, he used to be a chimney, thinking that if I exhale now, he will scatter. Thank you.
Now I'm going to introduce the last speaker tonight. I remember very well the day I first read Laura Tisdale Schoenberg Wright's piano music, Breathing in Atonality. The evening before, Laura had called me, exhausted from spending the entire day working on a poem. I went to her house the following evening, and while she made us homemade lentil soup in the kitchen, I sat at the front table, petting her dog and reading the poem. Laura's poetry, as I came to believe after reading Schoenberg, and then other poems she either showed to me or I snuck peeks at in the RCR office, Laura's poetry has voice, a voice that whispers, a voice that challenges, a voice that seduces. I say this because so much of the poetry Laura and I come into contact with almost every day, so much of the poetry that Red Cedar Review receives from all over the country lacks original voice, lacks stakes it is claiming, lacks a true examination of the poetic process, life to word, word to page. I also include Laura easily in a group of 5 to 10 very promising young poets I have come into contact with in the past 4 years. Her set of 3 poems, Schoenberg Wright's Piano Music, Breathing in Atonality, Topography, and What the Map Would Look Like, Green, Yellow, and Orange, 1960, won first place in this year's poetry Glendon and Catherine Swarthout Literary Prize. It is with great pleasure that I introduce to you Laura Tisdale.
Meg, no one's ever told me I was seductive before. Yes. Been waiting for that. I'm going to read 2 of the 4 poems that I got the prize for and then 2 other ones as well. And my parents aren't here, which is good, because this would end with a lot of questions from them if they were here. I was like, you don't need to come. Go ahead. The first one is a suite of short poems called Topography, and they each have another little title. Pangaea. Looking at me, you think out loud that I could have been your son, your father. We are snug, side by side, like pieces that should never have pulled apart. Subduction in one movement. Inhale. I settle into the rift just below her pelvis bone. She tips up to me, like a cup. I slide into the rift and under her. Exhale. Continent to continent, convergent boundaries. Being made by men and born on the surface of the same mother, we collide more like parts of similar continents. Our anger won't change us. It will be the mountain range erected between us. The erosion of you. The sea knows better than I. She was the first to insist the shore was always disappearing. The second poem is a new poem, and it comes from reading a lot of A.M. Holmes and immersing myself in various domestic disasters. How her house got redecorated. It began softly, bleeding like the low battery sound of smoke detectors. Soon it was as constant as the refrigerator humming, then as loud and unnatural as the thumps of tennis shoes in the dryer. Even when he was gone, the sound didn't stop. It grated against her. It bent her as simply as a napkin. She plugged in all the appliances at the same time, filled the blender with ice and turned it on, ran the dishwasher on the pots and pans cycle, dumped the silverware into the garbage disposal, and flipped the switch. She couldn't drown out the noise his silence was making. Seduction wasn't a way to get him to her side of the bed anymore. She folded her stockings into the bottom of the dresser drawer and tucked her high heels out of sight into the back of the closet. Instead, she arranged herself in the living room like an expensive armchair and tried to look inviting. She finds it easier to speak to him when he's at work. "Just tell me how to fix it," she said to the showerhead. "I'm scared for us," she told the flowers painted onto the kitchen table. "I've saved you from my anger 100 times, she complained to the coffee maker. "I won't hold anything against you," she proclaimed to the linen closet. "I love you," she whispered to the bedspread. Her words gather in the corners, as meaningless as dust. The space in her house gets smaller. Her house is vibrating. The plates rattle against the kitchen cupboards. The picture frames are shaken off end tables. She stubs her toe on the door jamb and catches her finger on the edge of a can. When he is home, she tries to tune him like a scrambled TV channel. He stirs and wakes in the night. He stares at her from his blank pillow. She sleeps too deeply and never sees him. He turns. He turns away from her. The next poem is for a friend of mine who I think is getting better, but dropped out of school a year ago and disappeared into the wilds of following fish, I guess, so, which could be pretty wild. And it was an assignment for class, and we had to use a line from someone else's poem, and I used a Ginsberg line, which I'm sure everyone will recognize. It's called February 2002, I Can Hear You, and it's for Amanda. I've watched you, angel-headed hipster, unravel windblown in your new city. I have seen you fill with water and pull apart, fingers, legs, elbows, like tissue paper cutouts, skimming the waves and moving in every direction. Your eyes are the eyes of a wolf stripped to instinct, desperate and cracking with madness. In the coffee shop before you left me, your fingers were twitching the distance between us. I'd run out of things to give you to hold. I am with you in Rockland, where my fears are your fears, slapping like the flippered steps of orderlies. I am with you in Rockland, where they cement you to the bed with pills that could muzzle a roar. I am with you in Rockland when you are writhing on the tile floor and calling out a name that is not mine. I am with you in Rockland when where you are screaming my betrayal. I measure intelligence and nice clothes into tall glasses that you won't drink from. I'm with you in Rockland where they've propped you in a corner. I'm with you in Rockland when staying afloat isn't enough to lash your soul to your chest. I am with you in Rockland, and I urge you into a shape you won't hold. I'm urging nothing. And the last poem is the Schoenberg poem, which is my favorite poem. And it's written in 23 pieces because Schoenberg wrote 23 pieces of piano music. But I'm not going to read the numbers because I think that really, and it's been argued about both ways a lot, but I think it breaks up the narrative trajectory of the poem and that it would just get really confusing and no one would understand it. So I'm going to read it without the numbers, but keep them in your head. Schoenberg writes piano music, breathing in atonality.
The notes sound like some kind of violence, sharpened and spat out like something bitter, spat out as if sound were an inevitable truth repelled by his body. The things that resisted. The notes tried to refuse such a permanent shape and the space between them. His glowing adversary attracted his eye, dared him to put it out, dared him to define what it meant to compose sound and silence. If the spaces between the notes could have made a sound, they would have growled. At the bar, she spent a long time trying to reconcile her face in the broken mirror hung over the sink. She laid a finger along her cheek, an expanse that felt complete, even though she couldn't see in the mirror where the lines matched up, even though her face appeared as two pieces separated, two different holes. Busoni writes to Schoenberg that the means of expression is new, but the piano writing is merely bare. At the bar, she watches the woman making circular gestures in the air while talking. The woman becomes more animated and whips the air into spheres of space. The woman cuts the thick, smoky air with the side of her hand into a shape like Christmas ornaments. She thinks that she is falling in love with this woman, a woman shorter and darker than herself, a woman decorated by the space around her, whose laugh slices into conversation. The woman laughs often and too loud, as if the laugh were a line drawn firmly, defining the white noise of so many conversations into two things. Before the woman, grandpa's shift key signatures. After the woman. The notes shone like something nocturnal, not a light-absorbing black like ink or paint, but something that glistened, something that made the white of the page more fragile, less established. They were the force that made sound where they were reflected, and yet, perhaps the black could only exist because of the page. She imagines the difficulty of moving from silence to sound, to find relief in bar lines, in double bar lines, thankful to have the staff held apart just so, for anything to give direction, to name the place. They were a steadfast coaxing, exist, exist. The notes he didn't write become just as important as those he did. The parts where he doesn't play at all sound just as loud. At the bar, where she is more than a little drunk, time has slowed enough that the woman's gestures smear in the air and take time to catch back up to her hand. She is thinking about the space that makes woman distinct, to be built around emptiness. Her uterus hangs in her, an uncertain note head without a stem to indicate which beat. At the bar, something inevitable gives way. Space crouches in her, something dark and tangible, a blackness demanding gravity. The fact of their existence, she and the woman, necessarily produces a third element, a field, perhaps magnetism, loops around them, shifting the space of the room in order to place one in relation to the other, shifting in order to define the field, to place the third object where she and the woman might reach for it. Busoni failed to grasp this bareness where the music turns in on itself and acquires a totally new cohesion. Whether what they produced would prove to be synthesis or merely a singular route of escape, the woman was sleeping in her bed. The sweat was drying, rising from their bodies and dissipating into the dark, like steam. The sun in the morning was muscular. It flattened the furniture to their least interesting versions, depriving structures of the drama lent to them by shadows. The sheet of music must have been a hard place to pin the notes. She and the woman were the darkest things sustaining the white sheets. Her hand made an adagio sweep across the sheet, recalling how in the darkness the woman had glistened, the places her hand had slipped against, and she found the woman filling the space between herself and the end of her bed. Despite all of the silence, the tension, and the friction, Schoenberg experimented without neglecting tone and timbre. Like reaching octaves, she stretched to conceal the places where they would not be even. But when they lay still, separated by half steps like the keys of a piano, held to each other by the movement inherent in stepping that kept them just so, she heard wholeness make a definitive sound in the room, swung between asymptotes of silence.